Epilogue. You never really understand a person until you consider things from his point of view, until you climb into his skin and walk around in it. Harper Lee, novelist, To Kill a Mockingbird. How did it all start, this crazy idea to write my memoir? The time I devote to the Canadian Rocky Mountains has helped me develop a deep appreciation of the land I chose to be my home and a more comprehensive understanding of myself. It is therapeutic for me. Turning to hiking could not have been timed any better in my life, possibly because I was unknowingly building up to severe burnout in my late 40s. Spending time in the Rockies has become as important to me as soccer was in my younger days, perhaps more. The more time I spend in the mountains, the greater affinity I develop for them. Looking at these huge structures is humbling. I reflect on how big they are, how quiet, calm, and unmoving they are. The snow, the waterfalls, the trees are all so calm. They fill me with peace. Those giant rock structures tell me they need to be in harmony with me. Being in this nature makes me feel relaxed and rejuvenated, grounded. Perhaps I truly am a wild child deep down, and I can finally reconnect with that part of myself while roaming through the mountains. Or maybe I'm just reflecting on the stories I was told about my father and unconsciously mimicking his acts and lifestyle, such as his love for camping and the outdoors. Looking back, I feel like all the big life decisions I've made recently can be traced back to my childhood. 2 years after my divorce, my daughters moved to live with me full-time. While the custody and legal battles were steaming, my friends encouraged me to enlist an individual counselor for myself and a family therapist for the three of us. The family therapist was necessary as I was struggling to bond emotionally with my daughters. I simply lacked the communication skills to understand and support two teenage girls. Individual therapy was needed because I was carrying unresolved pain from my past. The first time I understood my affinity to nature and the Rocky Mountains was when my therapist asked me, "When was the last time you felt completely calm and truly in the moment?" I thought for a few seconds and then remembered one moment during a trip to Takara Lodge in the Rockies. I was sitting in a deck chair on the banks of the Athabasca River in Jasper National Park. The sun was setting. I watched the stream of the river gently flowing. I admired the majestic Rocky Mountains, with their peaks covered in a soft layer of snow and the tall lines of trees glowing in the golden evening sun. I don't think I've ever been more at peace than at that moment. Perhaps coming a close second is the hours I used to spend by the Red Sea at Macha, watching gorgeous red, orange, and blue hues, which left me in awe as the sun descended toward the horizon. The ubiquitous sunshine provides 12 hours of life-giving light and sinks peacefully into the sea as if tucked in for the night. Every time my head is full and I get overwhelmed, I think about that evening in Jasper and try to reclaim that sense of peace. Yeah, I know. I've changed. I can be calm and serene. Who knew? I had always considered myself a true city boy, a business type, an office professional. Bragging about the number of reward points I was collecting during business flights and about having been assigned a corner office. Handing out a fancy business card with a glorified title made me feel taller. Observing the breathtaking architecture of cities, enjoying a variety of restaurants, and playing computer games, I loved it. All of it. But then something happened. I'm unsure what, when, or how, but something changed. I changed. This city man couldn't wait to leave the asphalt jungle and get lost in the great outdoors. Perhaps it started with the first trip with my daughters to Banff National Park, where I fell in love with the feeling of being so small at the foot of something so big and majestic. Something that wasn't manufactured but was created by Mother Nature. And during our time in the mountains, the thought suddenly hit me. Why do we live in packed cities when there is so much beauty out there? During my trips to the mountains, I started to capture images using my cell phone to remind me of those moments when I returned home. Occasionally, I share those images on my social media. Two ladies, Meek and Mary, took notice of my captures. Both spotted my knack for photography, a skill I didn't know I had. They often encouraged me to take more pictures and even suggested investing in better equipment and some training. Meek asked if she could save my photos on her device as she liked them so much. I permitted her to use my photos, delighted that my pictures were so appreciated. Since then, she has shown me proof that my images now hang on her office and home walls. Mary Noseworthy, the other friend, is a doctor of medicine and clinical assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Calgary. Mary is also a director at the Alberta Children's Hospital in the asthma clinic. She is a mother of four. One Friday in late December 2019, I phoned Mary to ask if she would accompany me to the mountains. She said, sure. She paused momentarily and said, this would be strictly as friends. Of course. What else could it be? I picked her up the following morning around 6. She hadn't had time to eat breakfast before I arrived, so she brought something for us to eat while driving. The 2-day plan included visiting a few frozen waterfalls between Banff and Jasper, Panther Falls, Athabasca Falls, and Sunwapta Falls. We also stopped at Lake Louise to visit Morant's Curve, an area of the Rockies where the train passes. We visited Maligne Canyon the second day, where 6 bridges displayed frozen water. The 5th of the 6 rewarded us with an epic view of the canyon's waterfall. The last stop on our way back to Calgary was Abraham Lake, the largest artificial lake in Alberta. The ice bubbles bloom under the lake like flowers, making for a stunning sight. We tried to focus on the lake and ignore the 90-kilometer-an-hour, 55-mile-an-hour wind we had to endure. On this 2-day trip, Mary asked about my childhood and early adult life. In those 48 hours we were together, I probably spoke about my life tales for 20 hours. Mary didn't mind at all and kept soaking it in while probing me for more. After hearing about several of my outlandish experiences at the end of day 2, she said, Adele, you should write a book. I'm incapable of putting together a short email without making some grammar or spelling mistakes. Writing a book would be impossible, I argued. Adele, you don't know it, but you're an excellent storyteller and have plenty of stories to share. I highly regard Mary as a level-headed person. Not only did she encourage me to write my life story, but she was also instrumental in helping me to recover my father's military records from the British government. She constantly reminded me not to brush off the notion of writing my book, and when I began the process of writing, she consistently inquired about progress updates. When visiting Yemen and Ethiopia with my daughters in 2010, they asked me to write my memoir. The idea didn't fully register until Mary raised the topic again 10 years later. I didn't think my daughter's suggestion was convincing enough, as they were 12 and 6 years old. Plus, my headspace was all over the place then. It would have been impossible to focus on writing a book. But several years later, after thinking about my daughter's and Mary's suggestions, I thought, yes, perhaps I do have a story to tell, and perhaps others can benefit from hearing my story. I began to collect my journals, my memories, and other documents I have kept over the years. The journals. When I embarked on writing my memoir, it was imperative that I give meaning to my life, explore my thoughts, see the progress I have made in how I view people, society, and the world, examine my interactions with people, and most importantly, reflect and touch on self-awareness. Introspection is one of the most important human skills to master to become a more compassionate and overall better person. A daily journal has always allowed me to have that introspection, even if it was just a taste, to reflect on who I was that particular day. I needed the exact time frame of when events happened. I've had many significant and profound interactions with people throughout my life. Keeping a journal helps me record those interactions. Reviewing them occasionally helps me remember and understand why those people remain so important to me long after the events have passed. Progress is a critical component of any person's growth and improvement. I did not become the person I am today overnight. In the context of my important life goals and personal objectives, my journals help me see what's important to me. I record my thoughts on a particular day. Most are irrelevant, but there are inspirational and educational moments for me as I get older and reflect. Meaning in life is a subjective concept unique to each person. My journal tracks my dreams and aspirations and, through structure, allows me to figure out what is important to me. My journals have been sources of information for me for this and my first two books. Even though I presented a fraction of my life's events in my books, 90% of my story was based on my journals. Once I finished extracting information from my journals, the ones from the first 16 years of my life, I took them to Abraham Lake in Alberta and burned them in a campfire. Looking at the flame, I felt like I was burning everything that had happened to me. I felt freed, unshackled. It was my closure. Everything was solved. I was finally closing the door and locking it behind me on that part of my painful past. My journals dating back to 1973 arrived, after much anticipation, in my mailbox in spring 2020 from Yemen and Ethiopia. The last batch came to me in June 2021. Many of the written records were lost in my journeys from Ethiopia to North Yemen, North Yemen to the US, back from the US to Yemen and to Canada. Despite my moves across three continents, the deaths of my many significant individuals from my childhood and early adult years and other circumstances, I was, however, able to recover plenty of records thanks to those who kept them for me. My sister and my former in-laws kept my journals in Yemen and sent them to me from there. I'm also still amazed that my aunt, whom I lived with in Ethiopia when I was between 10 and 16, kept my childhood journals all these years. I'm grateful that she did so and that she sent them to me when I started writing my memoir. While I was filled with joy at seeing my early childhood handwriting, I had a considerable challenge. Due to the time that had passed without my reading, writing, and speaking Amharic, about 45 years, I could not reread my childhood musings. I would recognize the letters and individual words, but could not correctly comprehend what was written. When writing my journals, I had permanently altered names. In some cases, I wrote paragraphs mixing and matching sentences and words using Arabic, Amharic, and some English. The intent was that if the journals were found, the person reading them wouldn't be able to read all three languages. The likelihood of someone understanding them was slim to none during those days. I feared that someone would read them and know what I thought and said about the characters. As an adult, I was now a victim of my scheme. When I began to go through my journals and plan out my memoir, I reached out to Betty, my childhood friend's daughter from Ethiopia, who was attending university in Winnipeg, Manitoba. I had half-siblings, cousins, and friends who could read the journals for me, and I would easily understand what was written if someone read them to me. But Betty Tilahun was suitable for this, as she was born decades after I left Ethiopia. She had no connection to the characters mentioned in my journals, so my private thoughts about relatives and friends would be contained. The arrangement worked fine. I took pictures of the journals and sent them to her via email or text messages, and we set time aside during the evening hours so that she could read them to me. For the most part, she was engaged, as the stories she was reading were interesting, funny, and sad. She didn't mind spending the energy and time, nor did she get bored. Several weeks and months went on with such a routine. She read, and I took notes. One evening, I phoned, ready to take notes. Betty said, "Mr. Adele, I won't be able to read this journal section." "Why?" "It's a bit embarrassing for me to go through the details."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, you wrote about something I'm uncomfortable discussing." I wasn't sure what was going on. I didn't think there should be any problems, as the section of the journal she was reading was written in 1982, while I was in North Yemen. There shouldn't have been anything to implicate anyone living in Ethiopia. I apologized and pressed her to explain to me. She said, "You wrote a few pages, a long journal entry, about the day you first watched a pornographic video." The phone went dead silent. I gathered myself and said, "I didn't know I had written on such a topic. My apologies. I wouldn't have sent it to you if I had known the content." She said, "Not to worry. I can read other entries you sent me in the same email." I didn't know what to say at that point. She had read something I had written almost 40 years prior. I asked myself, what did I write? While I was pondering, I was listening to her. Then I heard her saying, "If I may ask, do you mind if I ask you a question?"
"About what?"
Thanks for understanding my position on the matter, but I have a question. I said, shoot. After 3 pages of summary and analysis of the pornographic video, you said, that is not what I expected. What were your expectations, if I may ask? I didn't have a response. I didn't even know I had written a 3-page analysis. That was the last of my journals she read for me. After that conversation with Betty, I was afraid of what else might come out through my journals, so I ended the work with her. I turned my attention to my cousin, Sal Mandefro, who lives in Atlanta, Georgia, U.S. He is one of my Aunt Emmabet's children, and he was about 8 years old when I left Ethiopia. My Aunt Emmabet is the woman who rescued me from living on the streets of Nazareth, Ethiopia, when I was 10 years old. Sal was a baby at that time. My close relationship when I was a child was with his older brother, but Sal and I developed a trusted relationship over time. What surprised me about Sal was that he kept the letters I sent to the family from North Yemen to Ethiopia during the first few years I lived in Taiz and Hodeidah, 1980 to 82. Sal took charge of reading the remaining journals and assisted me in translating them into English. Most of the content in Volume 2 and 3 from my journal entry stems from his contributions. After reading my journals, he made one comment that I thought was a good observation of my situation in my younger days. If our mom hadn't come to rescue you at a tender age, it would have been impossible to put some structure or control over you. Luckily, her timing was unyielding. It is said it takes a village to raise a child. That is precisely what it took to raise me. And it was also necessary to have a group of people, including him, to complete my books. Perhaps both Betty and Sal enjoyed reading my journals more than my books. Final Reflections. Volume 1 and 2 were released in 2022. At that time, Volume 3 was well underway, but I needed a break. Working intensely on 3 books about my life was exhausting, and Book 1 in particular brought my childhood trauma to the surface. I put Volume 3 on hold for slightly more than a year and gave myself a chance to catch my breath. After all, this project was a marathon, not a sprint. During the break, I reflected more. I looked back at my whole life, the first 61 years of it, and acknowledged that in spite of my struggles and traumas in my early days, despite experiencing racism in every country I have lived in, even though I was deprived of being raised by 2 parents in a typical family home, I have had a good life. I have never turned to God and asked Him to help me, but He has always been there, looking out for me. What if my aunt hadn't rescued me from the streets? I likely would have died very young or been arrested for stealing food from markets. What if my chance encounter with Banser had never happened? I would have never connected with my father's side of the family, and I perhaps would have never gone to Yemen. What if the guards in the prison in Ethiopia hadn't had mercy on a young teenager? They would have tortured and killed me like they did so many others whom I was imprisoned with. What if the Iraqi diplomat whose car I rear-ended hadn't come back and advocated for me? I would have rotted in that Yemeni prison for weeks, months, or longer. What if I had never worked with John Reese in Yemen? I would have not had any connections to Calgary, and I may have immigrated to somewhere else in Canada, or not at all. All of these connection points allowed me to keep moving forward with my studies, my work, and my hobbies. None of these pivotal points are explainable to me, except that God blesses a child who has nothing and who needs help. He sent all of these angels to me to rescue me and look out for me. My life story is the result of the collective effort of humanity.